Hello and welcome to Escape into Storytelling. I'm Jennifer Bradley, and this is a chapter from my self-published novel, Virago. New episodes drop each Monday, and all chapters will be available at the end of the book. As always, there is no charge. Virago is intended for a mature audience, and today's episode contains language and implied drug use. If you missed last week's episode, it is available from the same podcast source. Now please, sit back and escape into storytelling with me in today's episode. Chapter 15. Winston tries something new. Adelaide encounters a face from the past. Having grown up in an inn in the docks, Winston had as much use for horses as a hunting hound had for dress shoes. He knew to avoid walking behind them, and liked patting them on the head or nose if they were friendly and not attempting to bite. Otherwise, the idea of climbing onto a horse's back and making it go places seemed like something that would forever happen to other people. As riding the city streets was not permitted, many people created riding yards in which to show off their horse flesh. Most were nothing more than humble grass or dirt-floored paddocks in front of barns. Others were grandiose and looked like rectangular outdoor theaters with lines of shaded benches for audiences. Barrel riding, where a horse threaded its way at full speed between barrels to show off agility, was popular, as were saddle dances, where horses were taught complex footwork routines, sometimes coordinating with multiple riders.
Luthus grew up in the saddle. Well, maybe not. More grew up cleaning saddles and mucking stalls. Still, he grew up around them. He once said he almost joined the Rangers, but he likes plucking at girls and not having to pack a lunch every day.
It was in Luthus's father's riding yard that Winston stood glowering at the barn.
It's only a week until the parade. This is stupid, it won't work. I've never learned in a week. I have more important things to do.
Luthus, reclining on a barrel in the shade, waved a dismissive hand. His mouth busied itself, crunching a caramel apple. The riding yard was modest, with a sand floor and wooden walls. A stone water fountain burbled against the barn. Winston ran a hand along his jaw, producing a rasp.
"Where's your father? He's been gone a while. Perhaps he's met with an accident."
Luthus gestured to the barn.
"He's getting gravel."
"Come again?"
One barn door cracked open. Luthus's father, Minos, glanced around the edge and waved at them, then disappeared back inside.
"He knows he's training me, right? He's not coming out here with some tiny pony, is he?"
Luthus snickered. Minos appeared again, holding one end of a lead. Seconds later, a horse's head appeared from behind the door.
"Is he bringing out a parade float? Some kind of wooden model I can—"
"Gods!"
Minos led something horse-shaped but house-sized into the sun. Its hoofs sounded like a gentle avalanche that he felt in his bones. The old horsemaster reached up over his own shoulder to pat the horse's nose.
"Winston, meet Daffodil."
Daffodil's coat was dark gold. He had a white blaze on his face and feathery white fetlocks. His hoofs were as big around as barrels. His tail was wrapped in an absurd little bundle that stuck out over his bulbous flanks like a stem on an apple. He created a respectable area of shadow wherever he went. Minos beamed.
"He's an Imperial Draft, one of the biggest in the city. Captain Micah Tilders and the Rangers rides his little sister, Daisy."
The horse lowered his head and regarded Winston with an enormous eye.
"It doesn't look impressed. Gods, I think I could fit my fist inside its nostril." Daffodil snorted. "We should do this another day," Winston said, 8 feet back from his pre-snort position.
Minos waved him off. He looked nothing like Luthus, being short, weedy, and plain. The only things they shared were their sense of humor, eyebrows, and Huathi coloring.
Don't you worry, lad. Everyone learns to ride on Daffodil. He couldn't carry you any gentler if he had hands."
He handed the lead to Winston and reached for something the latter hadn't noticed before, a stepladder.
"This is ridiculous. I can just walk in the parade."
Even as he said it, he knew he couldn't. All the rest of the captains waving and cheering from horseback, and himself afoot, he'd look incredibly stupid.
"You had a month to learn."
Luthus swallowed and opened his mouth when an audible pop as he worked the caramel loose.
I said you had all month to learn. Why didn't you ask sooner?
I meant to. I was going to. Later.
Winston huffed as he watched the old man set up the stepladder.
Well, you missed sooner, so welcome to later.
Luthus leaned back against the stone wall, ready to watch. Although Daffodil had a back that a small child could have done cartwheels across, it felt as narrow as a tightrope. Balancing on the creature's spine felt wrong, no matter how Winston sat. Minnis moved the stepladder away.
Do not panic. You are a shield of the city, and you can ride a horse.
What about whiskey? Luthus wondered. Minnis shook his head.
I won't let the little children have it when they're up on Daffy's back. Why should he get it? He'll be fine.
Children ride this?
Minnis nodded.
His horse blanket is big enough for them to make a fort.
Luthus smiled.
Children who ride well get to play under the fort when...
If you like, I could... Thank you, Lieutenant. That won't be necessary.
Well, I'm glad someone's having a good time.
2 hours later, Winston circled the yard. Daffodil was tethered with a lunge, and Minnow stood in the center of the circle, turning with horse and rider. The giant horse's trot was more of an earth-shaking rumble, but he had been true to Minnow's word and was as gentle as a lamb.
See? You aren't even using your hands to hold on anymore.
He's right. My legs are worn out, and I'm afraid if I stop squeezing, I'll fall off and die, but at least I'm not holding on to the saddle anymore.
Rein him in like I showed you.
Winston pulled on the reins, and the horse came to a stop.
That was almost fun.
Daffy's gentle and good-natured, but another horse might fight you. Commands should be firm until you get to know the horse. Minnis clapped the golden outcrop of the horse's shoulder. Poor Daffodil's earned his oats today. I do believe he's earned some beer in his oats, too.
Luthus clapped his hands together.
Good idea. Food's on me.
Minnis insisted they brush and rub down Daffodil, which turned out to be a task similar to massaging a granite cliff face. The horse's muscles stood out in great stony knots and were just as unyielding. By the time Winston and Luthus arrived at one of their many regular lunch spots, their forearms and shoulders were aching. They set to the meal of roast pork, bread, and seasoned potatoes. After they were sated, both scanned the room for any possible eavesdroppers. Luthus leaned forward.
Have you heard anything?
Winston sipped his ale and nodded.
Last night. How much do I tell him? And what do I tell him? Do I do what Gerald did to me and keep him in the dark for years and one day yank the blindfold off? Luthus is young, unmarried, with no children, and a good watch member. But does he want to know these sorts of things? Does he want to add weight to his soul?
Last night what? Winston blinked.
Last night I saw him.
Him who? I was talking about Adelaide.
Winston stared in disbelief. I was talking about a certain friend of ours who's taking to sneaking about the city in rags.
Oh! Any news? Winston sighed and tilted his head.
Perhaps the problem wasn't that I couldn't carry the burden, but that Gerald's burden had grown so heavy after so many years. Maybe two could carry it better than one.
He answered,
Too much to go into here, but I'll tell you everything when we can talk safely. But I can tell you this. Something happened last night. He didn't say what, just that he knew something was happening. Keep an ear out.
The lieutenant nodded.
There you are. A pretty shawl for a pretty lady, the old woman said as she handed Adelaide the shawl. It was dark forest green, knitted with big round stitches.
Adelaide thanked the woman and drew the shawl around her shoulders.
Warm socks, a warm shawl now, although I still can't imagine a winter without snow.
She plunged back into the throng of the market. Like all her Saturdays, she spent several hours at the academy, practicing her writing and helping Yerevny with her research, and liked to pass by the market on her way back. Gert's lessons on the what's of fashion came back to her as she made her way through the crowds. Yerevny and the librarian's lessons about Hwathi and Svaios filled in the whys.
The Hwathi don't wear their linens and cottons in winter, but they still wear sea glass, shales, and beads. The Vorossans do the opposite. They stop wearing Vitrelli's things and take their proper Vorossan furs, wools, and felts out of storage.
A short, Morosan woman walked past. Her hair was woven into braids and lay over the white fur nobik that spanned her shoulders.
At least now I know what the nobiks are. Gert didn't know.
She asked Yerevni about the white furs over tea that day. The scholar was pleased to explain.
What you're asking about are nobiks. They're passed down from generation to generation. We believe that inside every person are two beasts, one black, one white. One beast is jealousy, hate, vengeance, selfishness, cruelty, all those things that lower a person. The other beast is kindness, courage, brotherhood, generosity, forgiveness. They're always fighting, these beasts. The one that wins the battle is the one you feed. We wear the white to remind us to be kind and generous. Receiving a nobik means you are ready to be an adult, to bear children, to marry, to look after your parents, own a business, or join in battle if you must. Nobiks are made of lots of different things, sometimes even painted hemp. For a Vorosin, losing a nobik means losing everything, even hope. To live without it is to live ignorato, to live in darkness and despair.
The scholar fished in the front of her robe and leaned forward, showing Adelaide an amulet.
Many Vorosins in Vitral wear these under their clothes because nobiks are too hot.
The amulet was oval. Black and white swirled together to form the outlines of beast-style heads.
Beast heads indeed, Adelaide thought, hiding a smile.
Yerevni tucked the amulet away and picked up her teacup.
Do people wear black nobiks?
Yerevni pressed her lips together, her eyes on her teacup.
We do not speak of them. They have gone past Inyerato and become something else.
Inyerato. I like that word for some reason.
Adelaide left the market and made her way to the Weldon Road. She was worn out, her feet dragging over the cobbles.
And still I have a long walk home to East Coast up Seaview. Ah, well, I'll eat and turn in early, I think.
Addy?
Someone said, just behind her.
That's funny. People used to call me that in the village.
She rubbed her eyes.
Adelaide?
Is that someone I know, the voice?
Addy, is it really you?
The kindly face of a middle-aged man with florid cheeks and a nose that had seen better days looked down at her. A scar ran through one eyebrow, one of many dotting his face.
Don't you remember me, Addy?
She fixed on the blue eyes. They peered at her from years back. An old man on a muddy cart track, behind him a pathetic pile of goods on a cart, including a baby wrapped in furs. Her mouth fell open.
Tom? It is you,
the man cried, putting a closed fist against his mouth.
What are you doing here? Addy, it's so good to see you. Let's get into the warm.
They sat down at a cider hut for some hot drinks. An iron brazier in the circle of otherwise empty tables made the little space cozy. Over steaming mugs of mulled cider, Tom told her his tale.
We were only on our own for 10 days. 10 of the worst days of my life, mind you. I barely slept, and every time I did, I woke up thinking the baby'd be... Anyway, for 10 days I thought I'd made the stupidest mistake of my life, and if I'd been alone, I know I wouldn't have made it. But I couldn't give up, not with her there. As long as I could draw a breath, I wouldn't let her down. I wouldn't let anything happen to her. Not after what happened to her mother.
He paused to drink some more cider.
The 11th day, I come to a road. Just a dirt road, but twice as wide as anything I'd ever seen. I walked along it barely an hour before a patrol came by. I didn't know what to expect when all those people with armor and swords came around the bend. But they were kind. Gave us some rations and escorted us to a little town a few miles down the way. Nothing compared to here, of course, but it was more buildings and people than I'd ever seen in my life. And the people there were...
His eyes welled up and he dropped his head.
Well, you must know what it was like to find people, kind people, less than 2 weeks away, and roads and... Well, I thought I really had died at first. Our first hot meal. I'll never forget it. Mashed turnips and some old jerky tough as boot leather. But to this day, I've not had a meal half as good as that. We stayed there through the winter.
I told people the little one was mine, and they didn't even blink. I worked around the place doing this and that, and when the spring came, I decided I wanted a fresh start somewhere else. So when the patrol came back through, we went with them. That's how we crossed the mountains. Otherwise we wouldn't have made it, I can tell you that for certain. We got here about a year after I left the village. I found work as an odd jobs man, and then I started work in a mill. The family who own it look after little Nora while I'm working. They adore her. And Addy, she's as tall as a goose and makes just as much noise. Can you believe she's just past 3? So much time has passed, and yet none at all.
3 years ago. Our village murdered Nora 3 years ago. I lived in the ruin for 2, and now I'm here.
He shook his head and drained the last of his mug. But you, I've jabbered away. Tell me about you. How is it you're here?
She bit her lip. I'm sitting here talking to him in Glendale, where I live now, but I'm back in the village too. I'm on the path to Gran's house, and Garth is scaring me. I'm picking herbs in the forest. I'm watching Nora behave like a wild animal, and I'm afraid she was possessed by fairies. I'm standing on a stone bridge holding onto a rope, and the other end is tied to...
A sob escaped her, then another. Within seconds, she was crying. Tom wrapped his arms around her.
There now, Eddie, there now. We got out. We made it. We're here and we're fine, aren't we?
After a few minutes, she sat up.
There's not much to tell. Once my mother died, I tried to run away. I thought I might go live with Gran, but...
She shook her head.
My father came for me after that.
He came back.
He brightened.
But that's wonderful. What was his name again? It's forever been on the tip of my tongue. I just can't recall.
Funny that. I don't think Father could have told me his name either.
He changed his name. He's very different from the man you knew.
Tom smiled. I'd like to see him again. Whereabouts do you live?
Oh, he didn't come to the city with me. He wanted to stay behind.
He settled back onto the bench.
Ah, pity.
She told him about the ruins and about Neville and the travellers who wandered into her mist. She told him about Garth and his unholy band of monsters. She almost held her tongue, but then she told him about the Gaunts and their ability to change shape. He was quiet a moment and then leaned forward.
The mind can play tricks sometimes when people are upset.
She nodded as if this made perfect sense and went on. She told him about Garth finding her again later, and how he boasted about killing or manipulating everyone in the village into joining him, or killing each other.
And now it's gone. No one's left but us.
The tea shop owner, unmindful of them, moved around behind her counter, setting things to rights. Her clay jars of leaves made scraping sounds on the wooden shelves as she moved them about, dusting and polishing. After a slow nod, Tom said,
"Good."
Words jumped to the back of her throat. She heard Miriam's voice saying, "But that's awful." She imagined Annabelle recoiling in horror at Tom's words, imagined Gert's big hands flying to his own face in disbelief at the idea that a whole village of people could deserve to be wiped out. Instead, she sat back, thinking.
None of them were there. None of them knew what it was like.
She thought about Amos and how tired her stepfather always looked, even as he was whipping her, as he was emptying her dying mother's waste bucket in the darkness as he tried to keep the illness a secret. About people calling her a witch as that strange spring and summer stretched out, whispering it at first, but growing bolder over the months until they were shouting at her, throwing stones at her, refusing to sell her family bread unless her stepfather agreed to make her the village whore. She thought about the crowd clamoring for Garth's offerings of food, shoving aside their own neighbors and friends in order to feed themselves, and how quickly they turned on each other, as if they had been waiting years for the opportunity. Her jaw tightened.
As much as I hated them, I still pity them a little. And I hate the Gaunts more, and Garth most of all. But he's dead and gone now. Nobody deserved to die like that, not even them. Tom covered her hand with his own.
Adelaide, have sense. They were mean and hateful, and they killed my Nora because they were afraid of her. They treated you just as bad.
His face was hard, but the hand holding hers was gentle enough.
After everything that happened, they got what they deserved. Those people belonged nowhere, and that's where they are now.
No one deserves what they got, not even them. But he's hurt and angry, and he has a right to be. She managed a nod.
Monsters! Those people were monsters, Adelaide. I'm sure of it. I don't talk about what happened here in town with people. I think I'm afraid they'll think I might be like those people. I only left because something bad happened to me. I didn't try to help anyone before that or take anyone with me.
Tears shimmered in his eyes and ran into the lines and cracks in his skin.
I stayed there most of my life and I didn't do anything. And my daughter,
you tried to take me.
Did I? I don't remember that day very much.
He wiped his eyes with the back of his hands.
Only some things.
You said you'd rather take your chances with the living than with the hungry, hateful ghosts. But I didn't go with you. I was afraid to leave, too.
But you're here now,
he said, squeezing her hand and smiling.
Yes.
He wiped his face again and looked around, then chuckled under his breath.
Aren't these people funny? Them and their funny little ways.
She agreed, and they fell to talking of other things. By the time she and Tom parted, the light was nearly gone. Only a thin wash of blue lit the inky horizon, and torches blazed along Seaview.
Food and then bed. Tomorrow's another day to think on those things. At least I know he's here, and how to get in touch with him. I'd love to see little Nora again.
When the Anne and Belle was in sight, she felt her spirits sinking. She could hear someone weeping inside. She found Annabelle at the table, her face resting on her folded arms.
What happened?
The stout woman started at the voice, her cheeks wet and red when she looked up.
She came back from the market with some things, and I asked her to help me with the laundry, and she told me she didn't want to do that anymore. And we fought. And I asked her what she expected to do for money if she didn't work, and she said, Mama, I can work. Simon knows how I can make money.
Adelaide's leaden spirit sank even further.
And what did she say?
Annabelle looked away.
She said she could get her work as a tavern wench and a whore.
Annabelle nodded, new freshets of tears running down her face.
And I slapped her.
Oh, no.
Annabelle slammed her hand down on the table.
I worked hard, so hard, so she wouldn't have some man telling her what to do, and she ran right out and did it anyway. And now I don't know where she is, or when she's coming home, or even if she will at all.
Adelaide sat and put an arm around Annabelle's shoulders.
Miriam's her own person with her own life to live and her own mistakes to make, and maybe this isn't a mistake. Maybe she'll be fine. Maybe she'll get a license so she can make her own money. Maybe Simon does know best.
A less articulate part of her mind dismissed that and pictured swiping Simon's handsome head off his shoulders. Her mouth suddenly felt too small, her limbs weak and insubstantial, as if her whole body were made of linen.
I'm not losing another friend. She can hate me for it later. But I'm not going to sit by and do nothing.
Adelaide went to 4 pubs Miriam visited often. The girl wasn't at any of them.
Perhaps they're not even in East Coast. They could be anywhere in the city by now.
She closed her eyes and focused on Miriam's scent.
Cinnamon, apples, hair oil, basil.
Ah, it's no use. These city girls all take pains to smell the same.
Something was rising up in her chest, choking her. She tried to take a deep breath and couldn't. Panic made her head swim.
Over there, an open cellar door.
Gasping, she hurried down into the darkness. The cellar was damp and stank of rats and old onions. She stripped off her clothes and let the change take her. Bones resized and joints reset. Muscles stretched, restrung, and swelled.
Black fur skated over her naked body, unseen by anyone but a terrified rat. She stretched, pushing her forelegs forward. Her claws gouged the cellar's wooden floor, peeling curlicues of wood. She could hear the family moving about their little house above, a child clearing the table while parents wash dishes.
Find Miriam, protector. It seems so simple now.
A huge black form slid up the cellar stairs.
Miriam left the crooked sty just past midnight, skipping lightly down the steps and wrapping her shawl around herself.
Simon was so sweet when he saw how upset I was. He even gave me a present and cheered me up. Maybe I shouldn't have left, but I need to go home and talk to Mama. Maybe she's asleep. Maybe she'll wake up calmer tomorrow and she'll see it's not a bad job being a tavern girl or doing the other thing.
Torches burned in sconces along the street, creating little yellow islands. She walked along, humming. A sound caught her ear, a thud followed by quiet slithering. She paused and peered into the darkened alley to her right. The sound didn't continue.
Must have been a rat.
She walked on, humming to herself. Adelaide looked down at the man. He lay on the cobbles, her paw pressing on his chest. His breathing gusted in her ears, and his heartbeat was a hum.
I should kill you. You meant that girl harm.
His knife had fallen several feet away. His eyes were huge and glistened in the starlight, and he stank of terror and piss. She leaned forward, teeth bared. He couldn't speak, only let out a horrified wheezing that she felt in hot, wet breaths on her nose.
I can see myself. I can see my eyes in his.
They looked like silver coins someone dropped into clear pools with dark bottoms. She paused.
Go home. If you creep in the night again, you'll die.
She lifted her paw and moved back. The man scrambled to his feet and ran. This concludes chapter 15 of Virago. Stay tuned for the next episode, chapter 16, The Lady's Table Talks of Heroes and Adelaide's Friends Talk of Eggs. If you want to read along, Virago will be available in abridged print or ebook format from Amazon later this year. If you enjoyed this work, please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss an episode of Escape into Storytelling. Thank you for supporting independent and self-published authors like me. Until next time, be seeing you.